bit. Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12.
On the line from Boston, Chris Weinberg, and Chris is over there doing a bit of an exchange thing educationally, but he's more than a political observer. He's a keen student of politics. How are you, Chris?
Fantastic, Macca. It's great to be back on the airwaves with you.
It is. It's been quite a few years. Now, the election over there, we've you know, for us over here, we only see snippets. If we want to know what's going on, we either watch the Clinton News Network or Fox, depending on...
yep.
But, I mean, I watch Fox for amusement. But it's a pretty toxic election. Nearly 30 million have already voted. The polls, the polls are, majority of them are showing a Clinton win. We must remember, it's not the popular vote that matters; it's the electoral college vote. And there's a number of number of states that are swing states. And I should say, I've got Kirsty Marshall, an ex Victorian parliamentarian and Olympian, and Robert Doyle, who's been re-elected Lord Mayor for the third time. He was Lord Mayor when you left.
Indeed. It's nice to be in such esteemed company this morning.
Hi, Chris.
So, the feeling on the ground over there now, Boston, you know, Boston's a pretty liberal and a progressive place.
Yes, very much so.
Give us the perspective.
But with a Republican governor.
With a Republican governor, yeah. But give us the perspective.
That is true. That is true. I would say that in the onset of the third debate, there was a sense that potentially the Clinton campaign was sort of going to go into cruise control towards the finish line. But certainly in the last 10 days or so, the race has tightened considerably, and I think you can put that down to a couple of reasons. Firstly, the letter written by the director of the FBI, James Comey, last Friday has certainly played a role, particularly in directing news coverage back towards the Clinton email scandal that's dogged her for over a year now. And I think one of the most effective ways to view the movements in the polls over the last year or so is that whenever the candidate, whichever candidate is in the spotlight of the media, is the one who is usually suffering in the polls. So any time the Clinton email scandal is coming up, that's damaging to her. If there's any kind of scandal around something crazy that Donald Trump has said, something offensive to any variety of groups that he's targeted over the course of the campaign, his polling has suffered. So what we're seeing is that that's a key aspect in why the polls have tightened. But I think the other thing that we do need to realise is that America is an incredibly polarised country, and that irrespective of the quite unique and potentially divisive nature of Trump's candidacy, Republicans still will tend to vote for the Republican candidate. And I think what we're going to see on Election Day is quite a tight race. But in a way, I think this could benefit the Clinton campaign in a roundabout way, in that it at least ensures that no one is going into Election Day thinking the race is over and that their vote isn't required.
Chris, Chris, what a sad state of affairs that your earlier observation, which I think is very astute, that when a candidate is being scrutinised by the media, it's negative. You know, it's bad, and their polls go down. So it's not as if the media turn their attention to a candidate to look at what they might offer for the future of the country. They're just looking at their sort of negative parts, which is terrible. But I must say, I blame my side of politics for this. I mean, I think Clinton was always going to be the Democratic nominee. But if the Republicans had been able to lay down their guns at the door and get together and select a credible and solid candidate, then they would have had a great chance of defeating, I think, a deeply flawed Democratic candidate. They didn't do that, and therefore they were left with the lowest common denominator. So all of these senior Republicans who are lining up to belt Trump should have a good, long, hard look at themselves and their role in the pre-primaries. I remember I was talking to a very senior ex-diplomat who's close to the Obama camp, and he was telling me before all of this started that the polling that the Democrats were doing was showing that people like Chris Christie, the ex-governor of New Jersey, could defeat Hillary. Mm. But he laughed and said to me, but you know the good thing? The Republicans will never choose him because he is completely unacceptable to the Tea Party element of the party. And sure enough,
exactly.
he goes out in the first round of the primary contests.
Exactly.
So they couldn't.
And Robert, the best way to think about this, yeah, I was just going to say, the best way to think about this is that if you remember in the onset of the Access Hollywood tape that was released in early October, when Trump was bragging about sexual assault, you had a variety of Republican senators, Congress representatives, and governors unendorse his candidacy.
Yep.
And what you've seen in the last month or so is several of those candidates then re-endorse Trump because they've observed that. That principled stand that they took, often in the name of their daughters and wives and mothers, was met with the ire of the very active Trump base. And I think it's a reflection of how polarized the country is that the Republican base that Trump has activated and energized over the course of this campaign is holding Republican politicians to an incredibly high standard. And arguably, if Trump is to lose, And especially this argument has more clout if it's a close loss, Trump supporters would argue that it was because of the disloyalty of the Republican establishment that he didn't get over the line, which would indicate a very bitter Republican political culture for the years to come.
So, Chris, in terms of the marketing strategy by both parties, where do you see and what effect do you see it having the utilisation of celebrities?
So it's interesting. I think that one of the big talking points today, Kirsty, is that there's rumours that Beyonce might be taking the stage with her husband at a Hillary rally in Cleveland, Ohio, tonight. I think the thing that we've noticed is that for Trump, it's really him and a ragtag team of surrogates that he's had. But on the Clinton side, she's had the president, the first lady, the vice president, her husband, and a variety of very popular senators and governors campaign on her behalf. But I think at the end of the day is that for all the good that a speaker like a Michelle Obama can do for Hillary Clinton's candidacy, the fact remains that Clinton is still viewed as untrustworthy, as secretive or untransparent, and that at the end of the day, the voters are making a judgment based on the candidates and not necessarily the surrogates who are supporting. One thing I would say that the Clinton campaign has done effectively is they've mobilised, sort of activated the voices of a lot of the common people who've had an impact, who've been impacted by Trump, either contractors who had bad business dealings with them, or the variety of Muslims or Mexicans or people who are disabled who have felt offended by Trump's comments.
And do you think if both candidates had have been male, the strategy would have been different in this campaign?
Absolutely. And the thing, Kirsty, that I've really observed is that the kinds of issues that the country had, that we as Australians had with Julia Gillard's prime ministership, are certainly reflective here. And regrettably, even if Clinton was to win next Tuesday, those issues don't get solved. And arguably, they become even more heightened because those who were supporting Trump were Clinton to win would then be incredibly hostile to her. But I think these kinds of battles for sort of equality and fairness in treatment are ones that can't be solved with landmark moments. I mean, America still has a very deep racialized element in their country, and that certainly wasn't solved by the election of the first African American president.
Who would have thought, though, Chris, that we would see the glorious resurrection of Anthony Weiner? I was there. I still have all of the newspaper headlines because I was in New York at the time when that was all breaking. So I've kept them all because they are gems of their kind. Yes. But who would have thought that would come back to dog them? But, of course, it has through his now former wife being so close to Hillary. And, you know, in a race to the bottom, you actually get to the bottom pretty quickly and then you go further in this presidential race. It's just remarkable.
Yeah, there seems to be no end to the scandal.
I was going to ask, Chris, there is, of course, there's a Libertarian Party candidate, there's a Green candidate, who are going to peel off some of the vote, probably a little bit more from Hillary, perhaps, than from Trump. But the candidate in Utah, there's a...
Evan McMullen.
Who could win Utah, and how many Electoral College votes is Utah?
Utah gives 6 Electoral College votes, and if he was to win, I think he'd be the first non-major party candidate to win an Electoral College vote in several decades.
And the Republicans...
The polling seems to have...
The Republicans would be terrified of that because they normally count those 6 votes in their column straight up.
So he could...
Exactly.
He could either deny Trump the presidency, but it may well... deny Hillary as well. So you could actually end up with the election having to be decided in the Congress, which, of course, Australians don't even understand the Electoral College, let alone, you know, we have enough trouble with our Senate, in case you haven't been observing that. We watch... we've got a couple of listener comments here, Chris. I'll just run them past you. First one... said the documentary on Wiener was the best I've ever seen on politics. That was on at ACME in Melbourne. But the Greek finance, ex-Greek finance minister?
Milos.
Milos Yiannopoulos. He was on Late Line this week, and he says the alternative right and gay conservatives also support Trump, which is deeply disturbing. You know, there is a group, you're going to love this, Kirsty and Robert, Twinks for Trump. and a twink...
Well, I think the biggest supporter is Peter Thiel, who I think he founded PayPal, a gay man and a very strong advocate for Trump.
But, you know, with all of those, we were talking about that celebrity endorsement before. That's all very well, but I think it already talks to Hillary's constituency. You know, I'm thinking about those angry, white, middle-aged, not especially well-educated Americans throughout the whole Midwest. They couldn't care less that Pharrell Williams gets off the plane with Hillary, or that Beyonce and her... I mean, they just think, you're all part... Or well-regarded senators or Michelle Obama, they think, you're all part of the problem. Whereas Trump is the sort of visual manifestation of their anger, and they quite like that.
Absolutely.
And they love it when he says we're going to drain the swamp.
Yeah.
When he talks about... And I'm, you know, how American politics functions, I'm not unsympathetic to what he's saying there.
But that's the problem, is that we've got into a very bad habit internationally in politics of tapping into people's insecurities, their fears, their worst nightmares, instead of having the vision. And, you know, Robert's just been speaking very well about how the plan for the future of Melbourne is so exciting and bright, and we aren't galvanised by those conversations. We're galvanised by our worst case scenario.
But, you know, I reckon that's changing, Kirsty. I did a lot of polling, you know, throughout my election period, and yes, it's only the sort of 133,000, you know, that are in the centre of the city here, but that's a pretty wide cross section because there are owners, people who lease, businesses, the whole lot, and there is a move towards wanting a constructive campaign, not wanting a negating campaign, you know, talking about how you can work together with state and federal governments. And so I'm a bit heartened by that movement towards the more positive expectation of the electorate. We're not seeing it in the United States, that's for sure, but you just wonder if the calibre of the candidates had been different, the debate might have been different too.
I think one thing that needs to be said though, Robert, is that the media plays a tremendous role in this, but regrettably in the US, and I think generally, the media's bias is not necessarily towards one candidate or to the other. It's to a contest. And anything that makes the race closer or more competitive is what gets the headline.
Absolutely.
And I think that's why you've seen the preponderance, even from an institution like the New York Times, which Trump frequently mocks, sort of analysis has shown they have been the most prolific email story writer, if that makes sense, in terms of the number of articles they've written about the email scandal, especially in light of the fact that there's been no progress in the FBI's investigation in the last week. And I think that just reflects that policy is not really something that needs to be discussed for the media, even though there are tremendous policy stakes at play in this election.
Yeah. And Chris, with the development of technology, the media are finding it harder and harder to capture their audience. And I think that the reality is that they aren't in their jobs to promote the truth. They're in there to actually promote controversy
exactly.
and sell a story. So the greater they can
exactly.
actually show some conflict in on any level. And I, when I was thrown out for breastfeeding in Parliament, I had the woman from the Herald Sun that had actually brokered that story came up to me a couple of months later in tears and just said, "I'm so sorry, I didn't know it was going to cause the chaos." And I said, "Don't worry about it, you were doing your job. You know, that's exactly what you're employed to do, is to create a subject that will stimulate conversation, positive or negative." And that's what they're doing.
Do you think, Chris, the Bernie Sanders voters are pretty important. You know, he had a...
Absolutely.
Are they, you know, how significant are they going to be, you know, enough of them, if you look at the polls, and are going to stay home, or they're going to vote for a third party candidate? But how significant are they going to be?
They're crucial, but I think the thing that needs to be said is that, Bernie... If the Sanders voters are not to come home to Hillary, that's through no fault of Sanders. He's been very energetic in his campaigning for Clinton and very astute in realising the seriousness of the threat of Trump. The thing that I think is far bigger at play, demographically speaking, Macca, is the big changes that we're seeing, particularly among minority communities. You're seeing massive surges, particularly in the early voting statistics, in predominantly Latino and Hispanic community. But on the flip side, you're seeing potentially lower turnout amongst more African-American communities, perhaps reflecting the lack of President Obama on the ballot. And I think those demographic trends, they are going to be the biggest thing that we're going to learn from the election, whether the surge in the Latino vote due to both population growth and the sort of Trump effect, whether that is enough to sustain Clinton. And I think the thing that does need to be said is that with these tightening polls, the thing to remember at the end of the day is that in a tied battle, the more organised team is probably going to win. And I think that's an under-mentioned advantage that the Clinton campaign has, particularly in a state like Nevada, where the statistics show that the Clinton campaign is on pace to match the numbers that President Obama had there. And were she to win a state like that, that probably means that a state like Ohio is less pivotal to her.
Remember the Duterte effect, the Filipino effect. You know, the guy who can get out there and say, "This is a swamp, I'm going to drain it. You know, they're responsible for your economic woes. I'm the one who's the outsider, and I'm one." You know, so you can elect nuts, and then terrible things happen.
Absolutely.
You know, so all of our sort of political science might be swept aside in an awful maelstrom of hate that surrounds Trump to see him swept into power. I mean, I'm terrified of it, but you know, who can predict?
Yes, it can't be dismissed. I think that the threat of Trump is real in so many ways. I mean, one of the ways most clearly is the future of the Supreme Court and the next president being able to decide several new justices.
Let's fast forward to next Wednesday afternoon. First scenario is Clinton wins. Groups like the 3%ers and everything that say, you know, their job is going to be to walk alongside the protesters going to Washington to protest, you know, all fully armed, of course. Is there, with a Clinton win, a risk of armed revolt, like or is it that being overplayed, or is that real?
I think the loudest voice in a room is always going to get the most attention.
Yeah.
I think it can't be discounted, but I think the vast majority of cool, wise heads will prevail. I think the thing though that can't be dismissed, Macca, is that with either of these candidates, whoever gets elected is going to be the most unpopular person to come into the presidency.
Yeah, exactly. I agree, Chris.
Something that's going to be incredibly difficult.
I think, in my own heart, favoured aside, I think that Hillary will win in the end, but I think she'll be a single-term president.
Mm.
You know, those cracks that have opened up can't be plastered over now.
Yeah. And if Trump wins, Chris, well,
all bets are off.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Chris. As soon as you're just saying if Trump wins, my thing is I don't think I've ever heard anybody in a political campaign in the United States say something so outlandish as, well, I'm going to build a wall and I'm going to make them pay for it and I'm pushing all the other ones over. You know, it's not even realistic.
Yeah.
And yet here we are going to vote somebody in whose proposal for changes aren't even based on reality.
But hang on. I think it's one of the smartest things he said.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason for that is because I don't think anyone except the reddest of rednecks would actually think, okay, get out my trowel and I'm going to go down there and help with the bricks and mortar. But what he did was point out an enormous social problem for which no one has an answer.
Yeah.
And it plays to the worst dog whistle of, you know, they're swamping our country stuff. And so my friend Boris Johnson, who is known for a few outlandish statements of his own, I actually asked him about that once and he said to me, Robert, he said, say something outrageous. And then when you've got them listening, say what you want them to hear.
Yeah.
And I think the wall statement was exactly like that. It wasn't about physically building a wall, even though that was the exact analogy he used. It was about saying, I'm the one to stop this tidal wave of immigration that's illegal and is ruining all your lives. And that is
Robert,
a popular message.
There's a really good anecdote about this where Trump said that in an interview... that any time he felt one of his rally crowds was sort of subsiding in their enthusiasm, or they were paying less attention to what he had to say, he'd just go back into, we're going to build the wall, and who's going to pay for it?
Yeah.
Mexico, and the crowd gets riled up again. Yeah. He's very good at reading a room.
Oh,
and
yes.
His effectiveness of communication is certainly one of the things that has made him such a compelling figure.
Yeah, sorry, when you said reading the room, I just had a vision of Trump looking around the room and all these women going, oh, I read you. Yes.
Yeah.
I think that one of the highlights or the lowlights of the campaign was Melania speaking to a campaign rally saying that she's going, you know, her focus as First Lady is going to be to stop online bullying. I'm like, do you ever speak to your husband? Like,
exactly.
You know, I just think this is... I am waiting for the moment when, you know, Donald Trump appears on stage with Vladimir Putin or something.
It's yes.
I'm just saying, even I didn't pick that one. Because
both riding in on a horse with no shirt on.
Yeah. Gutsing it up.
We'll probably have a chat to you next Saturday, assuming you're not lining up for the Elon Musk trip to Mars. But just think of this, that a lot of...
Do you want a prediction, Macca?
Yes.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm going to say Clinton wins by between 4 and 5% nationally, and that the strength of her organisation on the ground is going to have her winning 322 electoral votes to Trump's 216, and that in doing so she's going to pull off very tight victories in North Carolina and Florida that are going to
get her
ensure
over
that she wins just.
Yeah, if Trump can't win Florida, he can't win.
And of course, there's one.
Absolutely.
There's another.
And we're going to learn very quickly.
Yep. There's another point of view.
A lot of early voting that will count early.
There's another point of view. We just have to go. But some pundits have said, if Trump wins, well, he'll get impeached, and Pence will be the president. If Clinton wins, she'll get impeached, and Kane will be the. So you know, who knows? look, we might. We'll probably speak to you next Saturday, Chris. Thanks for your time. Extended
My
time.
Pleasure.
Really appreciate the input. We've had lots of positive feedback from our listeners. And keep a low profile,
mate. If your listeners know any Americans, tell them to vote.
Yeah.
Get out and vote.
Cool. Thanks, Chris. Yeah. Thanks so much.
I met Joe Biden, the vice president, when he was out here opening the cancer centre. And I thought to myself, after meeting him, even quite briefly and talking to him, what a great pity that he had that family tragedy, which meant he decided he would not stand.
Yeah, he would
because what a class act he is.
Yeah, he is.
I agree entirely.
Yeah.
I thought it was also interesting, the reason I sort of edged towards that celebrity endorsement question to Chris was because of the vast silence that we do find with our Australian celebrities in the midst of a national election, and for very good reason. You know, it's our politics are viewed very differently, but I think that I was wondering whether or not they were using the celebrities for the only opportunity to get a positive message out.
Of course.
And how strategic that really is in their campaigns.
It's not just about winning votes, it's about securing your votes.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.